Okay, we're going to start the next section of the agenda. We've got two invited talks. The first talk is from Professor Matt Bishop from UC Davis. Matt is the director of the Computer Security Lab there, and he generously hosted the workshop on security in Genie. What was the day of that workshop? Was it in the fall? It was in January. Okay. And he's going to give a short report on that workshop. So please welcome Professor Matt Bishop.
Okay, the workshop was held on January 22nd and 23rd, and the call for participation asked people to contribute an idea or some observations about security. And the goal of the workshop, which I'll get to in a moment, was basically to encourage people to submit Genie proposals and start thinking about how security and Genie would work together. The National Science Foundation was the sponsor, thanks especially to Susie Iacono, Thais Nati, Lenore Zook, and Carl Levitt also provided a lot of help and insight for the workshop, and the Genie Projects Office, of course. And Chip Elliott was my co-chair. First, though, an observation about security. How many of you have heard the term think out of the box? Nobody? Okay. I really don't like that because it implies the existence of a box in the first place. I much prefer my wife's way of describing it, which is thinking sideways. You tend to look for things that, for outliers, you look at problems, but you look at problems and solutions in a slightly different light. Here's a quick example. In Missouri, the rules for the pick three said that a winning $1 ticket paid $500 with the correct order. If the numbers were not in the correct order, they paid $180. This seems very clear, very straightforward. What could go wrong, right? That's the sort of thing you have to look at when you're dealing with security. What are the strange cases that can cause all sorts of problems? And the goal of the workshop was to get people to start thinking that way, to begin engaging the security community in Genie so that security would be designed into Genie from the beginning on up, and also to look at security questions and issues and make sure that they were properly considered. There were several key issues. The two key questions that we were most interested in is, first of all, when you're doing experiments, what are the security implications of the experiments? And if you're doing security-related experiments, what types of experiments should Genie support? What capabilities would it need in order to support those experiments? But the second one is, how can Genie be protected? The question is not, can we stop Genie from being attacked? The answer is no, it's going to be attacked. The question is, given that it will be attacked, how can we protect not only the experiments and the experimenters that are running, but also the resources of Genie itself? This is particularly critical because there are plans to connect cyber-physical systems, such as SCADA systems and such, to Genie for experimentation. And those systems have interesting security requirements. So I'm going to present three different versions of what the workshop, the results of the workshop. The shortest version, the shorter version, and then the short version. The shortest version was that security had to be viewed as a scientific discipline, and that Genie had to foster a culture of scientific experimentation for security experiments and for other experiments right from the very beginning. If you needed to have the capabilities to do these experiments built into Genie from the start. The shorter version consists basically of 5 points. The first one, several of the points involve experimental validation. One of the things that's critical in science is the ability to reproduce an experiment, and not just for the experimenter to be able to reproduce it, but for others to be able to reproduce it and validate the results. So, Genie has to provide the capabilities to enable this. Furthermore, when we're designing security-related experiments, We want to be able to design experiments with the usual scientific method of hypotheses, controls, and measurements. And this leads to interesting questions about how do we measure things in order to provide the data that we need to analyze the hypotheses. Because there may be environmental differences between slices or between components of Gini that are being used. And one has to take those sorts of things into account. As a side effect of this, we're going to need to capture data in order to do this work. The question is, what kind of data will we need to capture? How do we capture it? And how do we save it and provide it and provide the results to others so that they can verify or refute the results of our experiment? This brings up some very interesting questions that I'm going to get to in a little bit. Now, Gini is an international network, as well as just a national testbed. And as a result, both nationally and internationally, it crosses many different jurisdictional lines. I'm sure everyone here is aware that, for example, the laws in Europe regarding privacy are very different than the laws in the United States regarding privacy. And in fact, within the United States, different organizations have different rules. My friends at Stanford, for example, have much fewer constraints on privacy than do those of us who work for the University of California, because we are quasi-governmental. The joke around campus is quasi-governmental means when it's to our advantage to be agents of the government, we are not, and when it is to our disadvantage to be agents of the government, we are. And I won't say whether this is an advantage or disadvantage, one could argue it either way, but one of the issues is in gathering data, we have to follow the government rules of protection, which means we have more constraints than do private industry, for example. And then the last bullet point, so to speak, is the notion of federations. When different federations are working together, there has to be mechanisms in place for the federations to communicate and be able to respond effectively, for example, to attacks or to other problems. It's very easy to design plans, policies, rules, and protocols to say, when a problem arises, this is how we will deal with it quickly and effectively. How many here have ever been involved in handling a security incident? Okay, those of you who have, how closely did the pre-planned rules, policies, and such apply? I can see some smiles. Basically, you don't know how well things work until you actually do them. And so one of the topics of discussion at the workshop was using some form of testing, penetration testing or something else, to see how well the rules that would enable Gini to respond to attacks, to heal the damage that was done and so forth, actually work in practice. So I'll get into these in a couple of minutes. I'll get into these in more detail. The executive summary is up on the workshop website, which I will get to in a moment, and I'm going to give you the highlights of that. The first big point was resource management. Who has the right to use these resources? That's not as silly a question as it sounds. I mean, the obvious answer is, well, if you can use Gini, you can use the resources. But there may be resources that need to be protected. There may be constraints on using certain resources in some countries that don't apply in others. So there are issues of credentialing, delegation, and identification, and so forth. And identification is not as easy as one would think, because to what level do you want to identify the person? I can show a UC Davis ID card that says I'm Matt Bishop, but all that means is UC Davis thinks I'm Matt Bishop. A passport presumably would have a higher degree of authenticity, one hopes. Identification also can be in the sense of a role. For example, I am a professor in the computer science department. That may be good enough for some things. Is it good enough for others? So you have all of these issues as well. And then you have the idea of social engineering to obtain illicit credentials. Cross-federations agreements and mechanisms, one of the issues there is accountability. If someone does something, how do you know who did it? Do you want to know who did it? There may be cases in which you need that anonymity. Those are issues that need to be considered. And then the third issue of resource management focused directly on the slides. When people are doing experiments, occasionally things go wrong. And if it's the only experiment on the computer, then there's not much of a problem. You can simply disconnect it from the network or do whatever, and the damage will be minimal and focused on that machine. But we're talking about a system now that uses slices across large numbers of systems. How is the separation between slices done? What happens if something goes wrong in one slice? How do we make sure it does not affect the something going on in the other slice? And the issue is not so much will it wipe out the data in the other slice. Presumably the separation mechanisms will prevent that. But it may, for example, deny resources to that other slice. So one has to be concerned about the mechanisms that are used to separate the slices and ensure that the resources for one that a slice needs are available. Recording events is one of the ones that I particularly enjoy. This speaks to the ability to take the experiment, rerun it, and then compare the results to the earlier run of the experiment to see whether or not you get the same thing. Now, you don't need to reproduce all the data, but you need to reproduce enough so that you need to capture enough so the experiments can be reproduced. And what makes this particularly interesting at many layers is some of the tools we rely on now, such as TCP dump, may not work very well in the future, because TCP dump makes certain assumptions about the nature of protocols. And if we're experimenting with new protocols, those assumptions no longer apply. But the area that really interests me here is the privacy issues. We've all dealt with issues of people recording information that ISPs or government agencies or whatever. But here we're talking about recording everything on the network. What are the rules? Can we record everything? If we do, would that violate people's privacy? And the answer varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So how do you handle that sort of thing? How do you decide what is the minimum you need to record in order to make the experiment reproducible? And one of the issues, key issues here, is what environment are you working in? If the environments are identical, you may need to record less than if the environments will differ. So how do you define environment? What is an environment? What are the features of the environment that affect the experiments? And so forth. And in order to enable validation, it's not just the person running the experiment who needs to be able to do this. Others also need to be able to do it in order to validate the results. So the mechanisms for recording data have to be reasonably easy to use, and they have to be effective not just when the experiment is running, but for replaying the data afterwards. And focusing on privacy again to a little bit greater extent. One of the ways that privacy is often handled is by what's called anonymizing the data. You take the data and remove all relevant identifiers. It turns out this has two interesting effects. In some cases, when you anonymize the data, you remove the parts of the data that you need to do the analysis. So how do you balance the two? What happens if you need the data, you need certain types of data for your analysis, but that data is protected and needs to be kept private? How do you ensure that, first of all, you have consent? There may be human-informed consent issues. And secondly, how do you control that data once you've got it? How do you secure it? Another form that's typically used is to anonymize the data, as I said, or pseudonymize the data. In other words, you make it so that under the right conditions, you can recover parts of the data that you're hiding. Well, what this means is if you can do it, someone else can do it. So how do you do this? Where's the tension here is very, very great. And the other question is, how do you get the data in the first place? If, for example, we do experiments with Genie that involve analyzing load or traffic, what's our population? We do it at a university, we're going to get one set of results. We do it at a military base, we'll get a second set of results. We do it at an ISP, we get a third set of results. How do we manage? How do we figure out what types of data we really want? And one of the proposals was to encourage ordinary users to use Genie. University students were the target that most people spoke about, because Genie can be integrated very easily into a university environment. But again, if you're doing data recording, then this raises the issues of privacy and so forth, particularly when you have students involved. So the key question here is, how do you decide whether an experiment is doing something that's going to violate the rules of the use without compromising the privacy of the experiment? So in other words, if an experiment is running and someone thinks it's gathering data that it shouldn't be gathered, they go look at the experiment to see what data it's gathering. That violates the privacy of the experimenter, because very often people do not want their raw data released until they've had a chance to analyze it and so forth. So how do you balance that? The architecture and the infrastructure came up quite a bit. In particular, the human aspects of and the policy aspects of these issues. A fun question that I like to ask my computer security class is, what is security? And if I have 50 students, I usually get 51 answers. If you can't define it, if you can't say exactly what you mean, how can you automate any mechanisms to look for it or to look for problems, since you can't say what a problem is in the first place? And this is particularly true across federated networks, where definitions of security will vary. So what aspects of security will Genie have to provide? Well, until you know what you mean by security, what you're interested in, you won't know exactly what those services need to be. And you can do it when you've got a definition of security, which may differ from someone else's, but you've got to be able to say what you're trying to do. And this also brings up a question of disputes. Suppose there's a dispute. The United States court system is not particularly fast. The international courts, according to my understanding, is even slower. So you're going to want some sort of an arbitration mechanism in there. And in particular, going back to this federated, this security support services, one of the issues also is that services which may be good in one context, those same services may be very, very bad in another context. For example, distributed denial of service. We don't want to trace which machines are sending the packets, because it's probably from a botnet. We want to know who fired off the bots in the first place, so we want to be able to trace all the way back. This would be considered, how many people would consider this a good thing? Nobody? Okay, you've probably spotted the other problem. You can take that same technology, give it to a government which wants to track down dissidents, and use that, and they can use that to trace back to the points of origin of the problem, of the dissidents sending out messages. So what do we do? These are some of the issues that have to be dealt with. The timely answers and taking action promptly are very interesting from the security point of view, because they effectively require a human to be available all the time, so that if there's a problem with the infrastructure, it can be dealt with very quickly. One of the issues here is that since joining Genie is voluntary, people will contribute the resources and people that they can. But for example, at a university, it would be very difficult to have someone available all the time. So how do we handle this? Who establishes priorities? Who decides who's allowed to use the resources? These are other issues that are related to security, because if someone is not authorized to use my resources and they do so, that's a violation of my rules. You can either centralize these decisions or distribute them. The problem with centralizing them is that means, in essence, someone else is controlling what can be done with my resources. And in many cases, that is simply unacceptable. And also, in some sense, it's antithetical to the notion of Genie as a distributed testbed. On the other hand, the distributed model allows me to control my resources, which is good for me, but may be bad for other experimenters. So this is another issue that came out at the workshop. And part of this ties into who controls what, and that leads us to the idea, if this thing works, of stakeholders. And there were at least three sets of stakeholders identified at the workshop. The first one are those who provide the resources. But then the second one was those who provide the data, because you may be doing experiments on Genie with data obtained from other sources, in particular anonymized data. And then those who will use the resources, the users and so forth. There may also be others. There was some discussion about whether or not users per se were stakeholders, whether or not it was necessary to go through an institutional review board, for example, for experiments involving people. Government and regulatory bodies will be involved as stakeholders, because when Genie crosses international lines, the governments will have something to say about what can be done, or even within the country. One suggestion was to use a clearinghouse to determine, to track who has what resources and who can access what resources they can use. This is goes back to the notion of a central clearinghouse. And this brings up the wonderful issue of IP. I don't mean IP as an internet protocol, I mean IP as an intellectual property. Who owns these experiments? The experimenter? The systems on which they are run? And if so, if they're run on many, on a slice that spans a large number of systems, how do you distribute ownership? Or the Genie Projects Office? Or NSF? Who owns this? The other thing that was brought out was ease of use. Typically, when people volunteer to do something, they expect the learning curve to be fairly short or fairly small so they can jump right in and start doing their research. And one of the issues that came out was, unless there is a set of guidelines or cookbooks, was the term actually used, explaining exactly how to do experiments, exactly how to control Genie and so forth, the level of buy-in will probably be much lower than if these things were available. Furthermore, you have the issue of the principle of what's called in security the principle of psychological acceptability. Namely, things should be very easy to use in order that people don't make mistakes when configuring or using them. For example, with electronic voting, one of the problems a lot of voters have is they don't understand the computer-oriented paradigms because they don't use computers. And as a result, we see a lot of errors due to human error factors. The experiments themselves, the workshop focused on security-related experiments quite a bit, and in particular on developing a science of security. The question that was asked was, well, why would security people use Genie? Can we get the same thing elsewhere? And what came out of that rather lengthy discussion was that Genie will be wonderful for certain types of experiments where we need very, very large scale resources that we don't currently have, spanning, again, many different jurisdictions, different types of equipment, and so forth. And so the idea was to try to develop experiments that develop experiments to validate or refute hypotheses that simply could not be done in the current environments. But one other thing came out of this, the notion of Genie as a teaching tool, because computer science experimentation is not often taught. People tend to pick it up as they go along. And it would be extremely useful to develop these experiments, to develop tests and so forth, to develop a way to teach people how to do good experimentation. And Genie would be a very good test bed for that. In fact, several people thought that the teaching aspect of Genie is just as, if not more, important than the experimental aspect of Genie. So the conclusion from that was that the Genie folks should provide a set of detailed examples of experiments in order not just to show people how to do them, but also in order to inculcate a culture of sharing, where you would be expected to share this type of methodology, these types of tools, this type of experimentation. We want this knowledge out there. And whatever methodology is used, the key observation in these three bullets is the bottom one. How does Genie affect experiments due to its unique features? Are there things about Genie that the experiments must take into account that they would not have to take into account if done elsewhere? For example, instrumentation effects, communications delays on the network, attributes like that. The types of experiments that the workshop came up with were largely involved DDoS attacks and defenses on a very large scale, larger than can be done now. And also botnets seem to be a very hot topic among the attendees. So these were the two particular ones that were brought up. But there were other types of experiments that were discussed as well. In particular, there are certain types of events that will be very high cost, but occur with low probability. Gini would be a great way to test out how you would react to those. And then exercises like Cyberstorm in order to develop plans and procedures when you don't know what you want to do. So let me wind this up with Gini itself. Can't prevent attacks, how do we minimize the effects? Okay. And what's the legal liability? Since it's international, since it's transborder, if somebody breaks into my Gini node and then goes to another Gini node, am I liable? Quite frankly, I don't even know the answer to that in the United States. In order to test how well Gini can respond and to develop more effective ways to respond, one of the suggestions that pretty much everybody seemed to like was to use the idea of penetration teams. Basically, have a set of teams that would go ahead and compromise Gini's security. They do it without disrupting experiments, at least that's the intention. And then see how Gini responds, see how the management infrastructure and the technical infrastructure of Gini respond to these attacks. This, the way we could control the damage that the attack, we could control or, well, we could control the damage that the attacks do, these planned attacks. We could do them in such a way that it wouldn't hurt the experiments that are going on, and we would have some idea of, number one, how well things would work in a real attack, and number two, how quickly Gini could recover. It was also noted that Gini is really providing a social environment in which people are sharing and working together and working side by side. So one suggestion was to have social scientists study the interactions of people and see how that would affect security, because ultimately, security is really all about people. So the conclusions were that Gini's security is a key part of Gini, and with security, the fundamental rule is build it in at the beginning, because if you don't and you add it later, it's not going to work very well. It's protecting Gini, protecting the experiments, and protecting other experiments from ones that go bad. I should point out that when I say go bad here, I'm also thinking of runaway experiments that are not malicious, were not designed to be malicious in any sense. And Gini does have unique features, at least for now. Its scale and its interconnection with the outside world make it a unique testbed for security. If you're interested in more information or reading the executive summary of the report, you can go to this website and there is a red banner up at the top which says click here for executive summary. The executive summary is about 10 pages. So it goes into a fair level of detail. The last thing that I wanted to close with was the tension about monitoring and privacy, because that's an area that I do some work in. It's always fun to look at old proverbs. Yogi Berra was famous for saying you can observe a lot just by watching. But the counter to this is the old proverb which says a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And what we want to do is make sure that the knowledge we get from Gini is helpful and not hurtful. Questions? Answers? Thank you.